Welcome to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here. We got a little bit booked up schedule-wise, so we only have one conversation for you today, but it's a great one. Our pal Dean Haspiel. You know Dean from his wonderful work collaborating with people like Harvey Pekar and his excellent series Billy Dogma, one of the really funny and imaginative alt cartoonists of our time. Well, Dean has been handed a great superhero from the Red Circle line of Archie Comics, The Fox. You might remember in the 80s, Alex Toth did The Fox, but he goes way back to the Golden Age and is one of those original 1940s mystery men. It's really fun when you put a superhero in the hands of a creator like Dean Haspiel, because I think you get a good combination of standard superhero fare, but on top of that, you get Dean's imagination making for very interesting stories, and certainly the story that he's got cooking in The Fox is one of those examples. The book starts on Wednesday. It is excellent, and it's a pleasure to talk to Dean not only about his thoughts on The Fox, superhero comics in general. We get into the comic book market as well. And Dean has just this amazing past, whether it's been collaborating with people like Jonathan Ames on the HBO show Bored to Death. He's years assisting cartoonists like Walt Simonson and Howard Chaykin. Dean always has very interesting and imaginative stories, and also a very interesting life. We talk a little bit as well about his famous godmother, the actress Shelley Winters, who has a lot more dimensions than what you might remember from the Poseidon Adventure and her appearance on Batman. We talk all about that with Dean on today's episode of Word Balloon. And it's all brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Great deals continue at InStockTrades.com. You can get 45% off Dark Horse titles, Marvel, Image, DC, IDW, Doctor Who books, plus these specific books that are on sale at amazing prices. You can get the Absolute Joker Luther hardcover from Lee Bermejo and Brian Azzarello. It's 50% off, just $49.99. You can get the Fables Encyclopedia Deluxe Hardcover Edition, 50% off, just $19.99. The Mighty Thor Epic Collection, War of Pantheons, 50% off. That goes back to the 80s, some great Thor stories from the 80s, $17.49. You can get Volume 2 of Rick Remender's Uncanny Avengers, 50% off, $12.49. And that's all from InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Don't forget, if your orders are $50 or more, you receive free shipping, and they make it easy with wonderful books at great prices. InStockTrades.com. All right, without further ado, let's get into our conversation with Dean Haspiel now on Word Balloon. Dean Haspiel, welcome back to Word Balloon. As always, sir, it's a pleasure.
Oh, always a pleasure to talk to you, John. Thanks for calling.
Congratulations on this collaboration. I think it's wonderful. Two episodes ago, I was talking to Mark Waid about it. And
yeah, I heard that. It was nice to hear my name spoken in kind words.
No, it's great, man. And he said right off the bat, he's like, hey, I'm scripting. This is Dino's baby, and I'm, you know, happy to script. But I'm really happy. I can tell from the first two issues that you guys have let me read that – you're as likely as big, if not bigger, of a fan of the Red Circle superheroes as I am.
You know what? It's funny. It's I didn't know I was as much of a fan as I turned out to be, because, you know, listen, when you're a kid, you know, it's versus. It's always, you know, originally it was hip hop versus rock and roll, and then, you know, Walk This Way by Run DMC and Aerosmith, you know, kind of clobbered that and mashed it up. But I remember I was like a Marvel Comics reading kid who drank Coca-Cola and watched the Yankees, you know. And then there was my friends who were Mets fans and, you know, Pepsi drinkers and DC and read, you know, DC Comics. But then, you know, the lines start to blur. But the reason why I bring that up is because I was always aware of the Red Circle characters. They were always like, when you're hungry for reading superhero comics, you know, so you do start to read Batman, you do start to read Spider-Man, you cross over a lot, and then actually those companies start crossing them over for you anyway, you know. So, but then there were these like other comics that were sticking around, not just the alternative stuff like, you know, American Splendor by Harvey Pekar or Chester Brown's Yummy Fur or all the Fantagraphics and Broad and Quarterly stuff, you know, like 8-Ball and Love and Rockets and all that. But then there are these other superheroes, and the thing is, it's like they tend to dust them off every 10 to 20 years. And that's cool. Well, the cool thing is that there isn't as much continuity to stick to. So as a creator, I get to have a lot of latitude, you know? And so one of the things, doing a little bit of homework, and, you know, being very aware of the Mighty Crusaders and all their iterations, now transitioning to the new Crusaders, you know, I had to do a little bit of homework, but, I mean, I was looking back at these archives online, and I was like, I remember that. I remember that character. I remember that guy. That they're all part of this universe. And, you know, it kind of just kind of glued all together when I started to actually have to perform for the characters, meaning, you know, writing and drawing and stuff.
Sure. So, I, go on. Yeah, please.
Well, I was gonna say, and then ultimately it culminated with, I mean, listen, you see Alex Toth do the fox, and it's a permanent imprint in the back of your skull, you know, like, I can't believe it. And he only did two issues. He only did two backup features of this character. And then you're looking for more, and it's gone, and you're like, wow. So then you start looking at other, you know, Fox stories, and he's a really cool character because he's so sleek looking. And then you realize, oh, he was created in 1940 by the writer Joe Blair and artist Irwin Hasen, who you know, later on I discovered him actually through Dondi. I remember those Dondi comic strips.
Absolutely, man. I was a Dondi kid as well. That's hilarious.
And then you realize, oh, wait a second, Irwin Hasen also co-created Wildcat. I see what he's doing here. You know, it's kind of like the iterations of an iteration. But no, I really loved rifling through these older stories, and it was just fun little ditties. It was what it seemed to be, and yet, like I said, they weren't so there wasn't a lot of continuity that you had to deal with. So it was never like, oh, I don't want to like try to understand like, you know, 30 to 40 to 50 years of this character. You know, it was just a basic, iconic, classic character. And the thing that always struck me was not only was he pulpy looking, but he's a superhero with no superpowers. He's just a guy that dons a costume. And that's what a lot of those older characters did. They kind of had Olympic strength, or they had really good detective qualities, but they were just kind of like folks who kind of took, you know, justice into their own hands. Or in this case, and the way we're writing him now, today, in 2013, is a photojournalist who basically was seeking kind of like really cool stories and would get into a lot of trouble. So luckily he had this other skill, this talent of being a good crime fighter. But what's starting to happen is that he's kind of become a freak magnet, and he's attracting so much trouble that he wants to quit being a superhero, but it doesn't stop. It's kind of like Corleone and Godfather, you know, he can't quit the business, you know, of being a superhero. And that's part of what we're positing here.
I love it. And I see elements of things that you've done in Billy Dogma in the past.
Absolutely.
And also, and I said this to Mark, and I'm sure you heard it. This really is, there's a kinship between what you're doing with the Fox with Mark and what Mark and Somni are doing on Daredevil, because not only is that street level character, but also to discover that Irwin Hasen was the co-creator, it goes back to those old Wildcat stories too. There's just something, there's dynamic energy going on.
There's a dynamic energy, and the good news is that we don't have to figure out how some major villain is going to try to destroy Earth. Well, maybe get to issue 4 on that one, but you know, it really is like about a character who can do, you know, thug, you know, beat up a thug. And I mean, that's what happened in the first issue. He basically is getting beaten up by fat O.J. Simpson and Patton Oswalt, you know, for all intents and purposes. and like, I wanted to keep that quality of that type of characterization in the story so that when I went off the rails, you know, which starts to happen, and as you were reading probably in issue 2, it really kind of switches gears a lot. But what I'm doing and hopefully succeeding at, and again, I would pray that my editor Paul Kaminsky and co-writer Mark Waid would make sure I'm doing the right thing, is to play with genre. And I'm kind of throwing a bunch of different genres together. When I thought about this story, but when I was asked, hey, why don't you come up with a 5-issue miniseries? And this was after I did a 6-page backup feature of the Fox, and they liked it so much, they were like, let's try to continue this. I kind of had this idea in the back of my head of kind of doing a mashup of some of my favorite, you know, all the 1930s pulp characters, like, you know, Flash Gordon, The Shadow, Green Hornet, Conan, all those famous characters, and kind of mash them up and tell a story that would have those little cameos in there but, you know, utilizing the Red Circle universe. And you know, I was kind of given carte blanche to kind of use who I wanted, but I said, no, let me kind of use the characters we haven't seen in a long while. And let me kind of put my polish on them or my vision of how to use them in this story. And as you'll read the story, they're going to start to pop up. And again, just like Fox is kind of an obscure character, these other characters are going to pop up and kind of ally themselves through this story. So in a way, it's kind of a teen book, but it's not, because it features the Fox. Mm-hmm. And as you've read, you know, he gets kind of sideswiped into this other realm called the Diamond Realm by this Queen of Diamonds, who's basically going around town, or at least on planet Earth, and trying to recruit some of the best pulp heroes to help save her husband from this this evil druid. So I do have some of the classic stuff in there. You know, like, you know, you can always trade druid for Ming the Merciless. You know, it's all the same kind of tropes, the same villains and hero tropes, but it's how you say it and how you tell it that, you know, makes it unique. And I'm hoping that the collaboration between me and Mark Waid is something unique. You know,
well, it's interesting. Why bring him in as a scripter? I mean, you have written your own stuff, but I know, and you say it as well in the back matter in the first issue that you guys have wanted to work together. But why for this thing? Did you think you needed Mark to help you out on this?
It's a few things. I publicly also said that when Mark Waid's good friend and collaborator Mike Waringo died in 2007. We were at Baltimore Comic Con. Yep. It was this tragic, depressing, you know, moment in time. And we were sitting there, and we had talked in the past about trying to collaborate. We concocted some little pitches that never went anywhere. And then we kind of made a promise to each other. It was like, we can't, like, not do something together, because you never know when you're going to die. I know that sounds bleak, but, like, you'll talk to people all the time in this field, and you're like, oh, I can't wait to work with you someday. I can't wait to work with you someday. And then that never happens. And then one day you die. Right. Well, I think the death of Mike Waringo really put a mark in my heart about, hey, I've wanted to work with Mark Waid, and he promised. So this was partially about making good on that promise. I found a project that not only I think Mark would be perfectly suited for, but he would allow me the range, because he respects me as a writer, to basically create the story and just kind of, you know, put a nice, sweet polish and give it a little personality and kick that I wouldn't necessarily bring to the project. I mean, the way I actually script, if you've read Billy Dogma, is a little offbeat and a little weird. And even though I've written the occasional superhero story for like a 4-pager here or an 8-pager there for Marvel and DC, it's not like they're knocking on my door to write their heroes. Meanwhile, here's Mark Waid, who's killing it with Daredevil and Hulk.
Yep.
And,
yep,
you know, and we both share a lot of the same sensibilities between, you know, me co-creating Activate and then Trip City and doing web comics and him doing Thrill Bent. I was like, you know, we're walking the same path here in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And he is just so well versed in the pulp genre that I think he can take anything silly and absurd that I throw into the mix and actually make a little sense out of it. You know,
I understand.
I mean, and that's what starts to happen as you read this story. It's like, wait a second, why is there like a big pink red sky and a pink sea and purple and blue diamonds all over the place? And like, and then there's this, our hero, like on a raft, kind of like Huckleberry Finn, you know, trying to make way and figure out what the hell's going on here. And also, I love the way Mark writes characters' voices. And if you're reading this, you know, the character's a photojournalist. He's a reporter, the Fox.
Yes.
And he writes him as if he's almost live blogging his own adventure a little bit. Like you're getting a inside voice while, you know, looking at the pictures and other things are happening. So it's a really good marriage of text and image where they support and complement each other, but they also yield different bits of information at the same time, you know?
Definitely. Absolutely.
And
man,
I think that works well. And not for nothing, but I mean, I had to write down a lot of agendas so that I knew what I was drawing here. And Mark has been really sweet to stick to a lot of my ideas, the emotional aspects of the story and and like, you know, some of the domestic disputes he's having, the Fox is having with his girlfriend, May, aka She Fox. And, you know, it's funny, as I was reading the second issue myself, rereading it, that is, I was like, wait a second, this is a married superhero couple. And I was like, we don't get into it a lot into the, in this first story arc, Freak Magnet, and I hope to be able to write more. But I really like the idea of a married superhero couple, even though right now that seems to be the big no-no. isn't that with some of the chatters happening these days about how
Batwoman
was supposed to get married, and then they said, no, she's not going to get married, but it wasn't about her being a lesbian. It was just that they thought married superhero couples are boring. Well, yeah, if you write them boring, I guess.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I know a lot of married couples that have a lot of drama. Trust me. You know?
No, I agree. And I also think, I think in fairness, I get it when it comes to Superman and Lois, although a lot of good writers made it work for the last 4 years.
No, good writers can make that work. And honestly, actually, I think one of the biggest mistakes in comics was when Lois found out that Clark was Superman. I think I said that on your podcast before, but I really love the duality of some superheroes where they are keeping their identity secret because of tension, because of danger, you know, and that,
sure,
and so on and so forth. But you can make certain superheroes be married to each other and make that really interesting.
Well, and also another Red Circle example, and I don't know if they've done it in the new books or not yet with the new Crusaders, but I know the Web was always a big part of the old Web stories.
I'd have to read that, but I because the Web was with Fly Girl. No, the Fly.
Or was it the Fly? It was either the Fly or the Web. I can't remember which one now. Maybe
something
it was
like
the Fly that I'm thinking of. But one of those Red Circle heroes. Yeah, I mean, he literally was henpecked. I mean, it wasn't like goofy comedy, but it was like, hey, you better not be going out fighting.
I know. And
much like what you're doing with May, which I do think is great and gives more pressure to the Fox as he's trying to get out of the business himself anyway.
Well, yeah, he's trying to get out of the business of being a superhero. He can't help but continue to be really good at it, even though he's completely distracted. I mean, he's letting these punks, you know, beat him up because he really is seriously thinking about so many other things. He's just distracted by it, and he could easily take care of them instantly. And meanwhile, the thing with May, I mean, you know, obviously the first issue is about to drop any second now, and then we're going to be talking about the second issue. But a lot of that's even in his own head. He's just thinking about the guilt of being a superhero and not taking care of trying to, you know, be a good husband and good father and live, you know, obtain the dream of living a domestic life.
Sure.
I always remembered, did you watch the Oscars? You know, every year?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember. It was about 10 to 15 years ago. But there was a woman who won for Best Documentary. And I remember how humbling she was. She came up on stage with all this glitz and glamour and all these people around her and famous people and actors. And, you know, she was, for all intents and purposes, nobody or nobody we knew. And she went to the Oscar for Best, like, Foreign Film. And she gets up. And I think it had something to do with the Holocaust or something, you know, sad like that. And she says, you know, she accepted the award. She was talking about how she wishes that the people that had died could know one more, what it'd be like to live one more night experiencing a boring night at home. Something about the word boring really resonated with me. And I was like, yeah, we're all so like hopped up and trying to like seize the day and, you know, and make things happen. And I agree with that philosophically, but I also forget how important it is just to stare out a window or to listen to something that hums or, you know, stare at a sky or a tree or, you know, I mean, getting a little sappy here, but
nice,
you know what I'm trying to get at?
A sense of normalcy, absolutely, and it would make sense that someone like a superhero would yearn for a mundane day.
That's
to just
what
kind
I'm
of,
trying to here with the Fox is he
sure.
wants something mundane so desperately, and it's virtually impossible for him. You know,
and well,
I know that's a weird kind of thesis to have, but I think that people can relate to that. You know, whether they're, you know, sitting at their cubicle or at some kind of job they don't like or something, you know, you always want the other thing, you know?
So, well, and further, one of your interviews I saw you say, and it kind of rings true, it's Michael Corleone in Godfather 3. Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back
in. They pull me back in. And it's also odd to start a story with a guy that's like, yeah, I'm kind of done with this. You know, like, and I want to keep going with that thrill line, because I think it's an interesting thing to explore. And as much as you can going to continue to try to obtain this boring domestic life, you know, of course it's going to be almost impossible. But I love that the adventure that will be thrown at him, and the fact that he really realizes he's going to have to understand he's really good at this, and he is necessary. It is necessary to keep the costume, or at least keep the costume under the button shirt, you know, for just in case. And actually May even buttons up his shirt in the first issue. She's like, well, you don't need the costume today. He's like, you never know. You know, because he does understand. He ultimately does understand. He needs to beat this other thing, who's probably is really who he really is. You know,
I understand.
Wasn't it Tarantino and Kill Bill that wrote about how he's not really Clark Kent? He's really Superman, but that Superman's commentary on humanity is Clark Kent.
Yes,
I always thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, the meek guy. No, Tarantino always has an interesting slant on, you know, superhero stuff, the Toho, you know, Japanese monster movies. It's always from a very different angle. But
sure.
Again, you know, I like this. Did you, and forgive me if you did and I didn't remember,
right.
But were you part of Marvel Tales or Strange Tales?
Oh, yeah.
I
did a 4-page Wood God story in Strange Tales Volume 2.
That's right.
And I got to say, I'm really proud of that story. I when they asked me, hey, Dean, would you like to do something for Strange Tales? I said, of course. And then I thought about, well, what would I do? And obviously it had to have the Thing in there because he's my favorite Marvel character.
Okay,
and then,
yes, now I'm remembering it. Yep, yep.
Yeah, and then I was like, let me look up the worst Marvel comic book character ever created and try to give him some respect, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm rifling through all these different comics, and I come upon a Marvel premiere that had this Wood God character. And I kind of remembered the Wood God character when I was a kid, but I brushed him off as something just lame. And
understood.
It was then confirmed by reading the comic. I was like, all he does is cry. This is a character that just cries. And then you know, I think he almost dies or something. And I was like, this sucks. So as I'm reading this, I'm like, no. Now I'm going to give him some props. I'm going to put him in an interesting story. I'm going to give him a nice little kind of like, it basically was like this epic mythological slant I gave to this character. And I posit that he used to date Alicia Masters before she dated Ben Grimm.
Wow.
And then the Celestials come in and all this other stuff. It's called The Left Hand of Boom. Again, only 4 pages, but it's epic. So,
well, this is the same kind of tone, and I mean that in a positive way. So people, and I know a lot of people that were really jazzed over Marvel Strange Tales.
Oh,
and
why don't they do that every month? They need to do that comic book every month.
Well, you're doing it for Archie, and I think that's great.
Thank you.
You know, honestly, I think, and that's the thing. And as you said, these Red Circle characters, because of their on and off again legacy. I mean, Mark
sure.
said it 10 times the charm.
Yeah.
But honestly, I think. But I like that, and it does give you guys opportunities to play with these in ways that maybe a traditional comic book can't be, because, like you said, there's a preconceived notion of course, Superman is going to break through the wall and
right.
save Lois and put Luther back in jail. But that's the thing. These characters give you that opportunity to do crazy things. And again, I can only you know, point to Billy Dogma and see
okay.
how your mind works and say, yeah, man, this is cool, and I'm on for the ride, and it's great. It really is, man. I've enjoyed the first 2 issues and look forward to the rest.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, there is kind of like a little tongue-in-cheek in terms of like the adventure and having fun with it. And one of the things I was trying to impress upon the editor and the folks at Archie and Red Circle was, you know, I want to write and draw the comics I want to read and see. And
yep.
and obviously that often entails, you know, your own childhood of the very things that made an impression upon you. And, you know, I remember that, you know, I was born in 1967, And obviously, okay, I was picking up comics in the 70s and whatnot. But it really, you know, it was the comics of the 1980s that really kind of locked me in. You know, between like, you know, Frank Miller's Daredevil or Simonson's Thor or John Byrne's, you know, Fantastic Four, and obviously, there, you know, the X-Men with Chris Claremont. There were so many good comics, you know, Howard Chaykin's American Flag, you know, all those first comics that came out, all the alternative stuff. But really, like, those superhero comics had such a quality to them. And there was such a great kind of, I mean, I know the 70s got wonky and weird with Steve Gerber and everybody, which is awesome. But it was the 80s was like the real true, like, second wave of Marvel, you know, in my mind. And
I agree. Well, also that and that direct market, too, that allowed the Firsts and Eclipse and all these other publishers to suddenly come on the scene.
Right.
And just, you know, and again, maybe growing up in New York as you did, you guys were used to the direct market. It really exploded for me. I mean, I'm 3 years older than you, so 64 kid. So, yeah, it was like you say, it was those 80s when, you know, the direct market really was this exotic new thing of, no, this is a comic book only store, and you're seeing a bunch of comic books you just didn't see on the newsstand.
Well, yeah, only
that
because, because they didn't have the newsstand distribution. So I was lucky. Listen, I've always, you know, as a New Yorker, we have so many things coming to us, and then you get used to that. It didn't occur to me, honestly, until I was in a comic book shop in Florida a couple of years ago visiting my mom, and I walked into a comic shop, and they didn't have everything that comes out every week. And I'm sitting there going, wait a second, what just happened here? And in fact, they didn't even have every Marvel and DC comic. They had most of the crossover event comics or whatever the special thing was going on with the company, but they might have had one copy of Moon Knight or, you know, Jonah Hex. And of course, none of the alternatives. And I'm thinking, what's going on? And then I realized, wait a second, these places, these comic book shops are curated. And my whole experience of comics has been curated by New York City. I mean, not only just comics, but life and culture in general, obviously.
Sure.
But, and then I realized how lucky I was that, like, I get to go to a comic shop and they have more latitude to take risks and pre-order stuff in hopes that, you know, people like me will pick it up and be interested. And that's obviously the job of a retailer. But it never really occurred to me until I was in a small shop in Florida, you know, how difficult it is actually to be a retailer or, you know, direct sales shop. And then I thought about the newsstands and, you know, how we don't really have newsstands anymore at all. And that's how I first discovered comic books. I mean, I would go once a week and I would just look at all the covers, and then you become committed to certain books that you like. And you know, it's not until years later that you're picking up comics because so-and-so wrote it or that guy or that girl drew it, you know?
Yep.
But at first it's all about the characters. And in a way, what I would love, obviously I want a job, but I would love for people to pick up the Fox and not care about who wrote and drew it, but just get into the Fox and get into the character and this, like, nutty little world that and these adventures that we put them through, and hope to get some kind of an emotional response to it as well.
Well, you know, Archie's always had a very easy, or I should say, strong method of distribution beyond the direct market. And certainly that's what, you know, has kind of kept them, you know, I think parents trust the brand.
Right.
And, you know, I wonder, I don't know, and this is a question I'm going to have to ask some of the upper management when I talk to them at Archie,
right,
what kind of push they're going to do for these Red Circle books in this era. Because I know it's a new management. And honestly, and I say this whenever I talk to Archie people, I really respect and appreciate everything they're trying to do at Archie, because I really think they are, you know, starting with the core group of the Archie characters, and whether it's Kevin Keller or the zombie book that they're putting out
right now.
the life of Archie kind of stuff, it just seems like they are having so much fun with this stuff, but also trying to reach as many different people as possible.
You know, they're really reaching out. They're really smart in terms of getting, like, certain creators to do variant covers, even though, you know, that's a marketing tool. They're still actually thinking about it and trying to attract people, because people will pick up a comic because it looks like the art of one of their favorite other comics, you know, and that makes sense. I mean, when you were just saying what kind of distribution, God, one of my dreams is to be able to go to a grocery store. And remember how you get the Archie Digest that were right next
to
the Reader's Digest? I don't know, because again, I'm in New York City, so I don't know what the kind of distribution it is outside, like in the hinterlands, you know. But I would love to see, you know, 5 issues of the Fox reduced into that little digest size and get it for like $4.95. Oh my God, on like, you know, crappy newsprint. That would be like a dream of mine, because to me that is comics. You know, this one of the things I've been trying to do here is not compete with Hollywood. I mean, I love the Avengers movie. I love a lot of what they're doing with these movies. But that's not what I'm making here. What I'm making here is a comic book, and something that should feel and look like a comic book. Something that, you know, you can roll up in your back pocket and you know, trade with friends or show it off or whatever and can't wait for the next issue. That's the feeling I'm trying to instill with these kinds of comics and these stories, you know?
I do.
With a Mark Waid, and that's why starting in the second issue, we're sparking a backup feature of The Shield, written by James DeMatteis and penciled by Mike Cavallaro, inked by Terry Austin. Talk about classic old school inker. By John Workman.
They're all being lettered by John Workman. That's fantastic. And you know, you introduced me to Mike, you know, when he was part of your Activate group. Plus, he and JM working on Savior 28 for IDW. You know, great team, and I'm glad to see them back. And I think doing stories of The Shield is an excellent idea.
Well,
it's great to see.
They're perfectly suited. Thanks for agreeing. They're perfectly suited. You know, I'm down the hall from Mike. You know, there are 50 studios here, but 4 of them are populated with about 6 to 7 cartoonists per studio. So there's a lot of cartoonists walking around here. In fact, a few hours ago, Mike was walking down the hall and he came over to my art table and he showed me the next page of The Shield, you know, that he's working on. And I love that. You know,
that's great, man.
One of the things I always wanted as a kid was the, you know, you always heard about Stan Lee or Marvel Comics bullpen. And Stan Lee would write all those, like, you know, those you know, items and his soapbox, you know, within the comics. And he made you feel like he was lifting the veil and that you were all part of this thing together. And then you, of course, you discover years later there was a bullpen, but it really wasn't that. There was a lot of it was fabricated to create this legend and lore. But it was also a way to kind of knit us all together, the creators and the fans. So one of my dreams has always been to have a real live bullpen. So, you know, for Mike Cavallaro to be, you know, come down the hall and show me the next page of The Shield on a comic that we're working on together just fills my heart. You know, I love that feeling. And those guys, you know, were great on The Life and Times of Savior 28. In fact, that was the book I pointed to when I was thinking about, all right, I think our backup feature should be The Shield, but I don't want to do it. I want to get these guys to do it because they could do The Shield, you know?
Absolutely.
And then we figure out a way how we're going to knit it all together, which I don't want to spill too many beans, but it all matters. It's all going to matter.
Okay.
So, chance in the second issue? Did you also get a chance to see The Shield? Was that in there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No,
oh,
they got me covered. So, no, I love it. And like I said, it makes sense, and it's a perfect next project for JM and Mike to do together.
Oh, it's great.
And also, you know, you mentioned those digests. That was my first exposure to the Red Circle Heroes.
Really?
Because it was – well, they were packaged with a bunch of Archie, Pureheart the Powerful, Captain Pureheart, Captain Hero.
Oh, I think it was called Superhero Digest or something like that.
Yep, yep. And it would have – it had Jaguar stories in there and the Black Hood and the Fly and the Web. And in fact, they had the Simon and Kirby version of The Shield that only lasted, I think, 2 issues before Marvel – or whomever put the – or was it DC that put the brakes on it because they thought it was too much like Superman? But,
you know,
I mean, it was – it really
who
made –
Who knows? I mean – go ahead. Sorry.
Was it before – no worries. I can't remember if it was before or after. I'm going to have to look it up. Stan Lee and Jack Kirby's revival of Cap. But, I mean, it really had that – I think it was before it. I think it was – because, again, I know it was Joe and Jack doing it, Simon and Kirby doing that Secret Life of Private Strong.
Well, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. was created before Captain America.
Yes. Yeah, it's the first – he's the first
patriotic
hero.
You know, superhero.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and all those – and the other great thing is they all were before Archie. I mean, these were like 8 or 9 years before, you know, Archie, which might have even – I think was a backup of The S.H.I.E.L.D. in really? Pep Comics
funny.
And stuff. Yeah, you know, it was one of those, you know, silly teenager books that were, you know, certainly there were a ton of radio shows like that and,
right.
and comic strips. And you know, that's kind of how Archie happened. And then Archie became the sensation and pushed the superheroes off the cover.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. You know, comic books, the reason why you picked them up, when, you know, back in the day was because they were our CGI. They were our science fiction, our video games. You know, the ideas that were put on the page allow the imagination to spring and go to other places, you know, and of course books as well, but our movies had not, and our video games or whatever had not really caught up to that. You know, technology is kind of, it has competed with the imagination a lot, but unfortunately a lot of us are so passive that we want the technology to take us away. You know, I get it. I understand why it's attractive and why it works so well, but yeah, no, I mean, if you had all those superheroes like running around between, you know, DC and I guess it was called MLJ, wasn't it back then? Those
titles
were published by MLJ, who later on would then, you know, transition to Archie Comics, because as you said or pointed out, Archie became so popular, you know. Today, I don't think you could invent an Archie character, you know, a domestic kid, you know, in a high school or whatever, however old he is these days. Actually, they do different things with him nowadays. Or, you know, and you know, congratulations for creating that Kevin Keller character, you know, and they really are smart. But I think, you know, superheroes were, the idea of them were really great. And of course, you could create iconic origins and have really cool superpowers. But really, a tip of the hat to Stan Lee and of course, Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko and those guys. But in 1961, when they decided, let's do something just a little bit different, let's match some of this domesticity with the super, you know, with the science fiction, let's say, and create, you know, more realistic superheroes. That's what I think finally clinched it, you know, and that's where, that's why there is such a great success with the launch of Marvel Comics and where it's gone. I believe is because they took that one kind of little idea and just expressed it even larger and bigger, made it important. And that's why we have, you know, more realistic superheroes. Of course, they got a little too realistic sometimes.
I
don't even know if that makes sense, to be honest. I think that's, and I actually wrote about this recently, you start to open up the can of worms. You know, when you try to make superheroes totally realistic, it doesn't make sense. I'd probably run away from a superhero if I saw one.
Well, and that's kind of the weirdness that I think Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons pointed to with
Watch.
So.
Yeah.
You know, I got Wikipedia open, and I want to be correct because I'm sure people right now are punching their iPods hearing me say something wrong. But Archie was created in 1941, a couple weeks after Pearl Harbor, December 22nd of 41, Pep Comics number 22. So only about a year or so after MLJ started with the Shield and some of these other superheroes.
So he was right there out of the gate with the rest of those heroes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just like, hey. Like, romance comics used to be very popular. What happened to romance comics? You know? Who knows?
Yeah, you know, I was really hoping. I remember Andy Watson coming out with a few of those in the early 2000s.
Oh, yeah.
And I had hoped that that was going to start a new romance comic trend. And I think some of your other brethren of the indie world, you know,
well,
I think some of their stuff.
Yeah, there's definitely romance comics in the indie world. And, of course, they insert that as much as they can into the genres, you know, because, you know, there's sex and there's love and all that stuff.
Yeah, conflict,
which,
absolutely.
You know, again, kind of is still odd how that conversation about how, you know, married superheroes doesn't make sense. I understand partially why, but don't say it out loud.
Well, I just think don't take any storytelling tool away.
No.
Creators. That's my thing.
I mean, listen, let's try a little something different in America. Instead of killing everyone, why don't we get them all married for a year? You know? Jeez, Louise.
They don't all have to be married, but at least let some of them get married, I think.
Yeah, forget it. I want them all to get married, and I'm going to pick and choose who marries who just for a year, and then they'll all get – then the next event is they all get divorced.
They'll get divorced. Well, you know, too, and I do understand this, unfortunately, because both DC and Marvel have become now such an important part of Disney and Warner Brothers, they don't want to have something happen, I think, in the comics that they'd rather have happen either on television or in the films, or, you know, just basic behaviors.
That's
why
Wolverine question. Wolverine
doesn't smoke cigars anymore because you can't have a character owned by Disney smoking cigars.
Right. Although I've seen a couple of characters smoking something in Marvel DC recently. It might have been in Nick Fury or something. It might let him still smoke because he's just, you know, a filthy old man these days. kidding. But, what do you think about, and this is interesting, because Marvel's done such a good job of kind of doing what they did in the comics, but now in the movies, right? Getting you to kind of hint at the next story, which would be the next movie, and advancing these characters and whatnot. Do you think that the movies are going to start to inform the comic books?
Yeah, I think we've already seen it happen a few times. I mean, when Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man had organic web shooters.
Oh, suddenly
they went away. So,
let's say a character died in the movie or got married in the movie, that's just because that's what we've been talking about. Do you think that they would then, it would be so in the comics, or do you think they're still kind of going to keep those kind of histories separate from each other?
We'll see. I guess we'll see. But I do think the potential's there. For example, Briefort doesn't normally listen to podcasts. Should this get back to you, Tom, and I'm misrepresenting you, I am always happy to be corrected. But I saw him answering somebody on Formspring a question about when are we going to see old Nick Fury with his own book?
Right.
And, you know, obviously the feeling was that they've made Nick Fury Jr., the former Marcus Johnson, who looks like the ultimate Nick Fury as well and looks like Samuel L. Jackson.
Right.
You know, they've made him kind of the main Nick Fury that's running around the proper Marvel 616 universe.
Right.
And, I mean, old Nick is still around, but he hasn't led in a book since John Hickman's Secret Warriors from a couple years ago. I don't know if they want him. Yeah.
Well, no, he's been Garth Ennis has been writing him in.
That's true. Yes, and I love that book.
You know, ones, and he kind of looks back at his past, I think Goran Parlov has been drawing them or something. They're unbelievable. They're so good. They're some of the best comics Marvel's putting out.
I agree. I think it's done, though. I think that limited series is done.
Yeah, I think it's done, and you're right. I mean, I wonder if that's a case of who wants to watch an old guy be the lead of a comic. And hell, I mean. Ever since, I forget how old I was, probably in my late 20s when Unforgiven came out. And I was so blown away by that Clint Eastwood movie because he is an older hero. He's anti-hero, that is. But I would watch characters like that. I'd pick up a book like that every week because really it's just how you do it, man. It's like there should be no rule of what you can't do. It's about how do you do it if you have a good idea and then I don't know. I mean, forget. I wish you would just quit with the focus groups and who to market to. You know, tell a good story. You know,
agree, man. Well, comic books, and as I always like to say when this argument comes up, the key word in that is books. There are no rules. There are books that feature old characters, young characters, children. It shouldn't matter. Like you said, it's a medium. And let it tell as many different stories as any other storytelling medium is able to do.
Right.
And I agree with you, man. And I don't know. Again, we're two guys in our 40s, I do agree with you that it frustrates me as well. This like manic need to serve a youth market when again, say that in the novel world, and most publishers would A, think you're crazy, and B, point to a bunch of successful books, even recently, that do feature older characters and tell great stories and find an audience to tell these stories. The mass audience is breaking down. So let's let every facet of that audience enjoy those kinds of stories. Go ahead. What were you?
If I was an executive at the big comic book company, I would also go, hey, wait a second. There's a bunch of 40-year-olds and 50-year-olds picking up these comics. Probably not as many 12 to 25-year-olds, let's say, because, you know, we're not marketing it to them necessarily, the kids. God, I said that with kids. Kids are actually 7 to 8 years old, right? Now I'm saying 25-year-olds are kids. I'm showing my age. But I'm wondering if part of that is because, you know, as we decline, you know, and diminish as we age, if we're holding on to youth by keeping, you know, our heroes a certain age, in a certain time and era, even though we're adding the cell phones and technology and updating, you know, the stories with our modern technology, I wonder if keeping a certain age keeps us young somehow. And that's why we read these things.
Yeah, we might live vicariously through them staying young. I can see that to a point.
Yeah.
I don't know, man, because I've seen, you know, we've seen examples of both. I mean, there have been things like, well, here's an old comic strip, but Gasoline Alley, those characters were allowed to live, die, and continue, you know, through their generations. Those
right.
families, you followed those families. Now, granted, I don't know how many 20-somethings are really looking through Gasoline Alley's history,
right.
but, you know, Sherlock Holmes was always, you know, well, actually, there are some stories where you see him as an older character and stuff.
Right.
Now, they weren't Conan Doyle stories, but,
Alan
I guess
Moore,
it's possible.
I think it was Alan Moore that said something really interesting years ago that one of the great successes of a certain kind of hero or anti-hero character is the fact that they die. And I think he said something that about like the fact that Sherlock Holmes dies, or that I think even Tarzan dies, is what creates them and makes them a legend and makes them iconic, is because there actually is an end game on those characters. Meanwhile, we're trying to, you know, we're year 75 of telling Batman stories, you know, and how many years
has
that been? Like a few years.
But when you think that every Batman story has been told, you got to hand it to a guy like Scott Snyder
to come
up with something new. So, I mean, I would say that as well about like Tarzan and Sherlock Holmes and Doc Savage as well, that,
right.
you know, new creators will get these properties and find new stories to tell about them. And in a lot of cases, very interesting stories.
I mean,
so, you know,
he was the gem of the new 52. Oh my God. That's the Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo. What they pulled off in Batman, like, was stunning. Like, it captivated me. And, you know, as much as I'm a Marvel fan, of course I read a bunch of Batman and Green Lantern and you know, all those, you know, some Superman and all those characters. But the fact you're able to inject such new life into the Batman lore is incredible, you know?
Yeah.
Those acts that come in every few years and kind of dust off the character while they're being made monthly. You know, I guess the interesting thing that Red Circle and Archie does is they go, okay, we did that for a little while and, you know, we'll put him back in the closet and see what happens later on. You know, like, they're not going to flog a dead horse. And I feel like sometimes DC and Marvel perpetuate comics that kind of should, you know, go take a rest sometimes. You know?
I agree. No, I completely agree. And I think we saw that with some of the new 52 books that are no longer around.
Yeah.
And every now and then I hear that from Marvel as well. I mean, God, they'll put big creators. I mean, Bendis and Maleev on Moon Knight.
Oh, that was great.
It was excellent, and I guess it didn't hit the number that they wanted it to hit. Otherwise, I'm sure that we would be enjoying a second and third year of that.
Yeah. If not
more. And I mean, you know, like you said, that's the thing. I think Archie is much more pragmatic about the Red Circle characters where, you know, either they're willing to license them out like they did to DC for, a while and let them try. And now they're trying again, much like they tried in the 80s. That's fine. I think that's excellent. You know, I really hope that, you know, what they're doing right now with the new Crusaders and what you guys are doing with the Fox and the Shield. And I'm sure there are more characters coming.
Yes,
I know that. What's Vito? Yeah.
Fruity.
What's Vito? What has it been announced what Vito is working on or no?
Oh, I can't really announce anything. I know Vito's done something. I know that they're talking to a lot of other, let's just say, name creators about working on other characters. There is something of a plan of a rollout. And I think the smart thing is to recognize to not only hire, good creators, but also give them that you know, wiggle room to kind of do what they do best and to use these characters to do that. And meanwhile, again, you know, putting a new modern twist on an iconic idea. You know, it's not the characters. It's a combination of letting a creator have a interesting idea, see what happens, see if anybody wants to buy it. I mean, who knows, John, who knows if anybody wants to buy the Fox? I don't know. It's getting a lot of a buzz right now, and we're talking about it, and I'm really excited because I'm working on it. But, you know, you go to a comic book shop, and I can't, there's so many comic books that come out, I can hardly see anymore, you know? It's kind of crazy. So
no, you're right about that.
No, hopefully people will want to pick it up. And then, you know, it will also be made, you know, available digitally the same day, which I don't know if I've ever worked on a comic book that was made, you know, available the same day in digital. So there's that potential for people to see it and read it and like it, you know. And listen, I can only do – luckily I've been given the opportunity to do what I like, you know, in the superhero format. I'm trying to have as much fun with that. And as you recognize, fans, personal fans of mine, that is a Billy Dogma and that kind of stuff that I do, that's definitely inserted into this, you know, thesis that I'm working with. So we'll get a little bit of that. You know, Mark Waid's polish and his personality totally comes through in these pages, I think. And, you know, what else? We got, as I said, you know, James DeMatteis and Mike Cavallaro, you know, taking what they do best and tell a really good story about an old-time patriot and putting him through the ringer. And I really love what James DeMatteis came up with in terms of Japan and Germany, and that's all I'll say right now.
Understood.
Yeah,
we get a taste of that in the second issue.
Yeah.
And obviously this is the backup, so it's going to be a while for it to develop.
Yeah,
go ahead and finish your thought. I've still got more questions.
No, I mean that's basically just being given that opportunity to like have you know the bean counters, you know, the presidents and the editors in chief and everyone just kind of put a little bit of trust in the creators, and that's what's kind of happening here. With Red Circle, and it's been really—it's something that I've never experienced in comics. I've done memoirs, I've drawn other people's stories, I've rallied the troops, I've created web comics, you know, collectives and whatnot. But to actually have, you know, the stewards say to me, "Dean, do what you do," you know, with our characters. That's been, for real, though. Like, not do an 8-page Spider-Man story, which is a lot of fun, or, you know, messing around with Wood God or whoever I've drawn, you know? In fact, I've done a Wildcat story written by Neil Clyde. But, to really sit there, and then what it does is it kind of sobers you up, and I'm, like, a little bit scared. But I'm also very thrilled by this idea. You know, I just haven't had this opportunity, John, like, it's very new for me, and again, I hope it works. We'll see what happens.
Well, I think, like I said, I can only go by what I've read so far. I think it's very entertaining. Let me ask you, as someone who really was doing digital in its infancy, and when we were still talking about digital and looking at it on our phones,
right,
or on laptop and desktop screens,
right,
versus the tablet era and stuff. Now that we're in the tablet era and you've really kind of had a chance to look at it and stuff, how much has your art changed, if at all, to accommodate the tablet format?
I think the only thing that might have changed is going from portrait to landscape. And what I mean by that is you play maybe with some layout that go a little wider, but that was just because of laptop screens or desktop screens. Now with the iPad, you can return back to portrait, or you can turn it sideways and get your landscape. But I don't think I've changed it that much. I still was excited by the idea of the square panel that you just do one panel at a time. But, you know, I guess that's if you look at something just on your little phone. But because a lot of people are looking at stuff on iPads and again, you know, screen desktops and whatnot, you know, it really, you don't actually have to do anything different from what you're doing in a comic book. Because I think what happened is the technology was trying to force the mediums to change or the formats of the mediums. But really, we had such a backlog, an archive of a certain style, you know, of looking at things. I think the technology probably changed to meet the history of all the stuff we've looked at. You know?
Okay.
There's probably a lot of complaints is what was happening. And also, when it comes to the bells and whistles of like click on this and you can get a sound or click on that and you can go behind the gutter and look behind the panel or behind the scenes, that's all cool and whatnot. But I'm more a purist. I just want the story. I don't necessarily need to know how, it's like that moment in The Wizard of Oz when you finally see the wizard. He's just a little old man. All you're ever going to see is a little old man behind all this stuff. swear.
I understand.
You know,
now, May makes a comment, or kind of a wisecrack to the Fox about how you know, he's a photojournalist and he better hurry to his job while he still has one.
Yeah,
are you going to address kind of what's going on with newspapers? I really thought the last season of The Wire did such a great job of, while they were giving their main story, there was that undercurrent of this newspaper that was helping in the investigations and stuff,
right,
was falling out of business. So it's like, you know, will the structure be there, and will anybody care if these, you know, journalists break the story if there's no newspaper to actually, you know, tell the people what's going on? And I wonder, is the Fox going to have that kind of worry about his day job?
You know, that's a really good question that we obviously don't really address in this first story because of what happens at the end of the first issue, and you get sideswiped.
Sure.
But it's a really good question because, yeah, how do you keep a job as a photojournalist? Maybe he would realize, wait a second, I need to be the Fox because I can get kind of the kind of stories and pictures that a normal guy, the very thing I want to be, can't get, you know, necessarily.
Sure.
And meanwhile, you know, how does he keep a job doing that? I think that is a good question. And that, maybe that's a question that will arise in the series, or that is if I have an opportunity to do more comics.
Sure.
With that, right now I'm treating it kind of just as a side job, and we did explore it in the first issue just a little bit. In fact,
yeah,
the backup feature is about, it's called The Picture Lasts Longer or Lasts Forever. I forget which way it went, but the idea is that we live in a culture right now that takes for granted because we have these phones that are, well, actually, we have these cameras that are phones and do everything else. And then, you know, people just dump every snapshot they ever took online every day without editorial consideration, without thinking about, you know, how we're, representing ourselves. And he discusses that in the back story about he's trying to get his son an actual old camera, and in this case, a Polaroid, so he can take a single snapshot and see what that single snapshot means, and
yep,
you know, how you could just stare at the and excavate the narrative gold from a picture. Again, I'm probably just, you know, I'm just sound like an old man now, but you know, as you get older, that's when these kind of things caramelize, and you realize how precious life is and how precious these moments really are. And you know, as a kid, you know, you live, you know, you feel immortal. Or in your youth, you feel like, oh, I can do that later. There's so much time ahead of me. And that's what the story is kind of a little bit about. It's about time. You know, how do you spend your time? And
yep,
as a superhero, why would you choose to spend it that way when you could just have a nice little barbecue with your family and friends? that's the stuff I think about these days. And that's coming through in the story. But again, I think that that's something that people can relate to.
Absolutely, man. No, I like – there's a lot of – social commentary on a lot of levels in this story. And that's the great thing, man. I think you guys achieve a lot here. I think it's a fun straight-up action story. I think it goes into crazy places that I think indie fans will love. There's enough superhero and supervillain stuff that would satisfy that. And
yeah,
again, like a good story, there are other layers, and some of them are, like you said, this social commentary. And
yeah,
you talk about social media in the first issue as well, briefly. And no, but honestly, I get that, and I'm glad that these
are
all
my little wink and nudge toward, like, you know, oh, I know how we can spark the apocalypse through social networking, you know? And it is a dig, and it is supposed to be funny. But, I mean, I use Facebook, like, 30 times a day, you know? Like,
I hear you. I see you on there, man. I see you on Twitter.
It's
absolutely
awful,
man. Now we're all doing it, man, and it's okay. I get it.
Yeah.
You know? You got to stay out there. You got to – no, man. You got to keep your thing. Before we started recording, we were talking about – you know, how some of these comic blogs that have been around for a while and stuff are disappearing and aren't around. And yeah, I mean, it's – but then new ones are coming along as well. And I think it's
yeah,
it's an interesting time. It's an interesting time. It goes back to what I said before where the mass audience is kind of fragmenting. And it's something that we've been aware of for like the last 10 years or so. I think the good news on that is that a lot of smaller but more focused, you know, platforms and – places for audiences to gather will exist and thrive and get the kind of entertainment that they're looking
for.
You
know, you make a good point about a focused kind of experience. Like, So you do comic book conversations, okay? You've been there for years. You're perennial. We know to come to Word Balloon because that's what we're going to hear and that's what we're going to get. And that's why I love talking to you, and I love Word Balloon. And then there's, like, you know, you have your Newsarama and your CBR, and then there's Hyman McDonald's The Beat, and you have Bleeding Cool. So you have, like, a good handful of the different comics websites that are must go to, you know? And then 1,000 little kind of, you know, hubs spring. And then they come out and they realize, oh my God, this is actual work. I actually have to, you know, put a lot into this. Or, you know, like, it's kind of interesting with the Comics Journal website has become a very interesting kind of, you know, destination point. Or I don't know if you're familiar with Tucker Stone, who co-owns Bourbon Street Comics, and he has a podcast called Comic Books Are Burning in Hell, which is a lot of fun because it's about these four guys that talk about obscure comics often. And half the time, I kind of want to jump in like a fifth Beatle and kind of argue with them about what they're talking about. So that's always fun. And then we discussed earlier Dan Greenfield, who now with Cliff Galbraith have sparked the 13th Dimension. So like,
really good
a lot
blog.
Of these,
absolutely.
You know, they come up, but it is about sustainability. It's about focus. It's about what do you do well and why we go to you or to them for the very specific experiences that we wish to gain from these different conversations, you know, that are happening, actually. But it's funny because, like, there's more of it happening than ever before. So I don't know, man. I mean, even though we only have a certain handful of comic book shops, and I don't know how many people are actually picking up comic books and reading them, we certainly have a force, an army that's, you know, towing the line, you know, behind the scenes.
I agree. You know, Heidi posted over the weekend, I want to say, The View, when Whoopi Goldberg did a segment on The View about New York Comic Con. And it was interesting seeing the talk back underneath that. And you
I did see that. It's funny because I read the comments before clicking on the video.
Okay.
I know there was a big back and forth between, oh, this is good for comics. Oh, this is corny. And then I was like, well, yeah, it probably is essentially good for comics. But then I did click the video, and I was like, really? Like, and I love Whoopi Goldberg, and I was like, come on, guys, you really did it that way? Like, how do you pitch a comic book? You need a cape, a sword, a helmet, or whatever, a shield?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, man, you know, that was some producer's idea just coming up with, oh, I don't know how the audience of The View will understand this. We'll do it like this. Like, we'll make a parody out of it. And I was like, that's corny. Now, again, I don't think it hurts comics. But it is, it was a little too silly for my taste,
that's,
to be honest.
I understand where you're coming from, man. I didn't take it that way. Although, when you say that, when she initially said, I'm trying to pitch a comic, it's like, you're Whoopi Goldberg. You would have no problem pitching a comic.
Yeah.
It kind of in the same way, I'll say it, Comic Book Men on AMC, you know, all those guys are Kevin Smith's guys. Kevin is on the show.
Right.
When they supposedly, and I'm putting air quotes up there, walk into Dynamite and, hey, we'd like to, you know, pitch our comic book.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Dynamite's already publishing a lot of Kevin Smith's books.
Yeah.
The comic book audience knows that. It's disappointing that they make that kind of fabrication choice rather than just state the obvious and say, hey, we got a comic. We want to do it. We know you work with Dynamite, Kev. Do you think you can help us arrange a meeting?
Yeah.
Even that, I would accept that over the golly gee whiz, Mr. Dynamite, that we have no relationship with.
I know.
We want to do this. It's like, come on, man.
I know. I mean, we know better now. We know better. We know that. Listen, when I went to film school at SUNY Purchase and we took our documentary class, the thing I remember most was they said that the minute someone points a camera at you, you can't help but perform. And you could be running away, you could be shy, but you can't help but put on a little bit of an act because you now know that you're being recorded. Something is happening, and you could try to break the camera or whatever if you don't like it, but you do put – it changes you. The fact that there's something recording you, it changes who you are and how you behave, you know? And so because of that, and because we have, quote, reality TV, which really isn't reality TV, as you know. We're lifting the veil so much so that we know all the nuts and bolts. So let's just, like, let's be honest about it a little bit more, you know?
It'd be nice.
So anyway, but conversely, on the flip side, you know, I used to not really have an opinion about cosplaying.
Okay.
But, you know, I go to these conventions, and initially I'm like, oh, what is going on here? There's all this stuff. I got to say, I really like it now. I don't know what's going on, but I kind of like, there's a lot of imagination. There's a lot of I don't know. There's something that to me is kind of a real true fan. I mean, hopefully they're reading the damn stories and buying the comics too, but you know,
I think they have to be. I think they have to be.
They have to
get
be,
those
right?
costumes. Yeah. To get those costumes as right as they are.
Yeah.
Come on. At the very least, they're examining the art. And
definitely.
No, I agree with you, man. And then, no, it's
I like it. I used to kind of bash it like, oh, you know, they're not real fans. I actually don't even necessarily care. There's just something about going to a place where everyone's getting their freak on, basically. And it's a no one's shy about it, you know, and they're coming out of whatever, you know, reality that they're dealing with in life. And they get to be something else, or they get to feel empowered. And I don't know, I'll probably have a lot of my friends make fun of me, but I think there's something beautiful about that.
No, I think it's incredibly creative. I think it's a great tribute to the source material that they're trying to capture in their costumes. And I agree with you. The only thing I don't like is when they clog up the line and I'm trying to get to the next booth.
Yeah. Nobody should wear wings. All right. Just kill the wingspan and maybe cut short the capes. But yeah, you know, like.
Or have a designated. You know what was great about New York was it seemed like that hallway between the main floor and getting to Artist Alley was where a lot of the photography was happening.
Oh, okay.
And that was good. I mean, it was still happening on the main floor.
Right.
That drove me nuts, and it really kept me from spending a lot of time on the main floor.
Man.
But, you know.
I spent 3 days there. I never made it to Artist Alley, and I'm so embarrassed by that.
Shame on you.
Believe it. Yeah. And, like, that's where my boys are. That's where my people are, you know? I'm like.
Yeah, man.
I was so consumed by the things I had to do between signings and certain interviews and whatnot, which, okay, that's a good problem to have.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
and you got to get the word out. Absolutely.
It's gotten too big to the point where at one point I found myself staring up at the ceiling and just looking at the perspective lines of this place. And I was like, oh, my God, it's San Diego Comic-Con. It has become San Diego Comic-Con. It's too big. It's getting too big.
You know, Dino, I'll respectively disagree because what I've been telling people since the show is that at least at San Diego, there is enough space and they've got even the main floor down to the point where I think you can still move that and navigate around that main floor.
In San Diego?
Yes.
Okay, I haven't been in like 6 or 7 years. And 6 or 7 years ago, I think, was the teetering point of being too much for me. So I haven't gone back because I have an allergic reaction to it right now, I think, because I get claustrophobic. So I think.
You really? Okay.
Yeah, I think that's what happened. But it's good to know that if they're working it out, I would love to revisit, you know?
Well, I think so. All I know is I get more frustrated by the main floor at New York than I do at San Diego. And that's really not. That's not the organizer's fault. It really is just the floor space of the Javits Center versus the floor space of you know, the San Diego Convention Center.
Right.
Because I mean, it's just it is bigger, and also you can just so much easier duck out to that outside area the main hall
and
you know, run down to the other end of the con much easier in San Diego than you can in New York.
Right.
And that's the thing. And again, in New York, it was like, okay, we're all shuffling, and then, all right, let's all stop because, you know, 50 people have to take a picture of Sailor Moon.
I know.
And I understand. I get it. It's all good and everything. And also, I really love – I'm telling you, man, I'm sorry you didn't get to Artist Alley because there's no problem moving around in Artist Alley. Everybody is set up down there. And I end up spending the majority of my time when I'm not at a panel or on the main floor. That's where I'm at is Artist Alley.
In all seriousness, you know? I know everyone has their way, and you probably do this a lot more than I. I was also feeling some serious fatigue. I'm also working 7 days a week on trying to make this monthly book happen.
I understand.
I'm not used to that. So when I went to go do this, I was like feeling a little fatigued to the point where, like, you know, I know there's also pauses at night, and I only went to like a few of them. How do you do it? Like, do you?
Oh, dude. Well, you're
you go into a bathroom stall and sleep for an hour. Like, what do you do?
What I did was honestly, I cut my day short, knowing that I had stuff at night, so I would leave the floor and the con around 4 or 5. Take a quick nap and then go out. But honestly, all I did was Friday night I went to the Paley Center, and got to do the Brave and Bold presentation they did over at the Paley Center. That was
cool.
And then Saturday night, and I look forward to talking to Blake Bell about his book, but the Society of Illustrators had this presentation, Fantagraphics at it, for Blake Bell's new book, The Secret History of Marvel Comics,
which is
all about, and it was at it was all about Time Lee's pulp era, and they had
Al ordered that book. I just ordered that book about, you know, the bullpen and Jack Kirby and all that stuff.
Yeah, that's Sean, if you're thinking of Sean Howe's book from last year.
No, Blake Bell. I just ordered it. It's about that era of Time Lee and Marvel, early Marvel.
Yeah, it's, you know, I hope that they get into the, I assume that it might be a first book of maybe that he'll do a second volume, because it only ends in the early 50s.
Oh,
and
really?
I'm really interested. Yeah, I'm really interested in that, like, period when Stagg was coming out and stuff.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you see the Marvel creators from the 30s and 40s, or really the 40s and 50s, working on the traditional pulps. And there's some, you know, kind of lurid pulps that are in there as well. But I'm really interested in that period of the 50s and 60s with publications like Stagg, and seeing what the bullpen guys were doing of that era. Because they're talking mostly about, like I said, the timely stalwarts of the 40s and the 50s.
Right.
And that's why, you know, Al Jaffe and Stan Gober were kind of represented. And they were there at this panel being interviewed by Blake and I forget the doctors.
Amazing.
It was fantastic. Jaffe's 93, 94 years
old. I know.
And he's still like sharp as a tack.
I've been on two panels with him, and I'm just blown away. I'm like, how does he do it? You know, he's just, like you said, sharp as a tack. He's on point, and you're like, bravo, man. Good for you.
Yeah, man.
You know?
Absolutely. You know, that guy's got a good 50 years on us, and he's fine.
Oh, man.
He's like, my first day at Timely, he goes, I was 20 years old, Stan Lee was 19. And you're like, oh, my God, that's awesome.
That's amazing.
and Stan, too. Stan Gover, doing great, man, and still sharp. Yeah, they told wonderful stories. It was terrific.
The Society of Illustrators. I want to say, was it Friday night? I think it was Friday night. Paul Pope. I just missed his presentation. He was signing a Battling Boy, and they had all the Battling Boy art up there. I mean, we got a chance.
It was still all up there on Saturday.
Did you see the artwork?
Yes, I did. It was incredible.
Man, why don't they publish the book that big? It's so amazing.
I know. It's literally coffee table size.
It's so amazing to look at. Like, that guy, it's a crime that they're publishing it so small. Come on, man. I understand it's like a publishing, you know, marketing tool, whatever, maybe kids only, or whoever they're marketing only read a certain size. But it really is a crime when you see the original art. It's like,
You're right. That reminds me. I gotta talk to the first second people and fire up that Paul Pope conversation.
Oh, absolutely. You got it.
So, too funny, man.
Yeah,
excellent.
Yeah.
So what else, Dino? I understand that the book is keeping you busy now that you're on kind of this monthly schedule and everything. But sucking out all your time, or what else you got coming?
I'm two or three pages away from finishing issue 4, and then I dive into issue 5, which will probably, I hope, to wrap by Christmas. Then, hopefully by Christmas or maybe the next month, I'll have a better sense if from Archie and Red Circle to see if the Fox is doing well to green light more, whether it's another miniseries or a series or whatever. I have been filing a lot of notes for what I want to do next with the Fox. And then, you know, they obviously have other characters as well that I'm kind of snooping around and taking a look-see at. So, you know, I have a really good relationship with Paul Kaminsky, my editor, and actually a lot of the folks at Archie and Red Circle. They've been very supportive. So let's see, fingers crossed, that I get to do more. I did draw a Batman 66 story.
Outstanding.
That was supposed to come out in the second issue and got pulled because it features Killer Croc. And apparently, once it was done, they were like, somebody said, hey, Killer Croc wasn't in the regular in the Batman 66 TV series. He wasn't even created then. And the editor of the book said, yeah, that was part of the point of doing the series, was to introduce some of these characters that weren't in the series. In fact, we talked about it, and the fan base raved for it and wanted it, so that's what we're doing. So I think what they're doing is they're putting it on hold right now because they want to get a bunch of what is known, you know.
Into yeah,
the
I
series.
Understand. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So there's that story, but then I'm hoping to do another one, let's say, come January.
That's great. I
earmarked. So,
I saw Jim Chadwick and Jim's the editor. Oh yeah, he's a great guy. I've known him since he was working with Art and Franco on the Green Lantern spinoff series from the cartoon. And yeah, no, I like Jim a lot. Jim's got a great eye, and he always picks creators that I'm a big fan of. And I was congratulating him on how much I enjoyed Batman 66 so far. And I've talked to Parker too.
Parker,
I'm assuming, was the writer that you worked on.
Yeah, he wrote the story I did, and it's in conjunction with a King Tut story. And both of them have not come out because they're, you know, one informs the other. And so I'm hoping that will eventually come out. But meanwhile, I am slated to hopefully do a second one that does utilize a villain that was in the TV series.
Okay.
In fact, I told just a funny little bit that you might remember. I might have told you in the past. But I was like, and this won't be the story that I'm doing, but I am, if it continues the series and does well, I'm kind of begging Jim and or maybe even get Jeff or somebody to write it. Hell, maybe I'll write it myself. But I want to do a story with Batman and Robin where they fight Ma Parker hold on a second. Oh, God, why am I blanking? The Ice Guy. Not the Superman.
Oh.
Mr. Freeze.
Yeah, Mr. Freeze, of course.
Now,
yeah.
But Mr. Freeze, the Otto Preminger Mr. Freeze, and Ma Parker, Shelley Winters. And I'll tell you why, because as you may know, Shelley Winters was my godmother, okay?
That dude, I didn't know until I read that in the Fox, and I meant to ask you, so please, go ahead.
So that's a whole
awesome.
Other story. I mean, I'm here because of Shelley Winters. She introduced my parents.
Wow.
So I exist because of Shelley. Now, the reason why I want to do a Ma Parker, Mr. Freeze story in Batman 66 is because she and Otto Preminger taught me how to swim.
Wow.
Now, how crazy would that be, or fun little kind of like, you know, footnote in my life to be able to draw those two actors in a Batman story that of characters they played that also kind of had a little bit of a major impact on my life, you know?
That is insane. So, like, how did you meet Preminger?
Apparently, we were at a hotel somewhere that had a pool. We were visiting Shelley. She might have been doing some theater thing. Otto Preminger was there. I don't know if he was in the thing or hanging out with her or what. And my dad probably threw me in the pool and said, learn how to swim, walked away. And then Shelley, who was actually a really good swimmer, if you remember the Poseidon Adventure.
Absolutely. One of the key points to her character. Yes,
exactly,
indeed.
Exactly. So she's sitting there with Otto Preminger, and they both taught me how to kind of basically paddle and maybe breathe underwater. I don't know. You know, the basic tenets of swimming was because of them.
Was he as tough on swimmers as he supposedly was on?
You know, if only I could remember. Don't forget, I was probably a kid. You know, I mean, I was a kid.
I understand.
But
that's
I don't
awesome.
Remember that. Wow. I have lots of fond memories of Shelley, of course. But,
yeah,
I mean,
tell me about
go ahead, what?
No, tell me about your godmother. Absolutely.
Okay. She lived like at 72nd Street, you know, right next to, what's the name of the place that John Lennon lived in?
Oh, the Dakota.
The Dakota, right next to the Dakota. In fact, she was one of the first people to call 911 when she heard gunshot.
Oh, wow.
Pretty crazy, huh?
Yeah.
So, anyway, we would go over there, my family visit with her, and the upstairs neighbor was an actor named Farley Granger.
Of course. Absolutely, from Strangers on a Train.
Strangers on a Train.
Absolutely.
And he would hang out. He'd almost be there all the time. And then I remember as a kid fighting over the remote control in Shelley's bedroom to watch TV with a guy named Al Pacino. And then when I was really young, Robert De Niro babysat me a couple of times. I mean, of course, I don't have real, like, memories in terms of, like, things we said or anything, but I remember faces and I remember being around these people, you know?
You got to write a book about that, man. You got to turn up this book. You want to play hide and seek? We're going to play hide and seek, okay? That's awesome, man.
That's, My brother wanted to act when he was younger, and she was directing a play at the Actor Studio, you know, the famous Lee Strasberg Actor Studio.
Absolutely.
And after school every day, I would take my brother down to that studio. They'd be rehearsing, and there would be all these different actors and all these famous people. And then, you know, we'd have them over for dinner and have, like, little dinner parties. I mean, I grew up around a lot of really cool, famous people to the point where I had no qualms going up to, quote, famous people, because I kind of just knew that there was something known as fame that was a part of someone's job or something. So I was never really shy. I didn't really get shy, I think, until I met people who did comic books, because suddenly, you know, I could handle actors and directors and, you know, that kind of celebrity. But to me, to meet, like, you know, just an author or writer or anybody who drew comics was shocking to me. And I guess because of what I assigned to that in my heart, you know, in terms of doing comics.
Interesting. Did you have how aware were you of Shelley's whole career? Because I know a lot of people know her later years and, you know, and even like Batman 66, but man,
right.
You know, Lolita,
right.
And,
right.
I mean, and
right.
God, you know, and forgive me, man, but, you know, she was hot back in the 40s
oh, yeah.
and 50s.
Oh, yeah.
My God. And I know she was good friends with Marilyn Monroe.
Yep.
And you know, really could easily be the next pinup you look at in a magazine. And I'm
yep.
telling you, Shelley Winters in her prime, my goodness.
Yep.
And certainly her
yep.
book was notorious
yep.
for all of her relationships. So, like, were you aware of any? I mean, it's your godmother, so I don't know how much you
– I was aware.
You know, when you're a kid, you know.
I was aware that she was, you know, had two options. Oscars, could be a very serious actor to the point where she taught acting, but she
yes.
was not shy of doing a horror film, a B movie. I mean, she did
right.
it all. She must have done 100 movies. So she was so versatile and such an interesting person because of that. She wasn't like just doing the one thing she does well. She would do things because she liked the idea of it or because she wanted to play that character. And again, she was just, there was nothing, I mean, not that she was crass, but she was very bold, you know, like
cool.
those things that she talked about. She's very honest.
That's fantastic, man. No, honestly, I read her book years ago. And as I say, I mean, as a little kid, I just knew her as the fat old lady in Poseidon
That's
Adventure.
What she was kind of
and,
most famous for. And she actually
right.
gained weight for that role in Poseidon Adventure that would then transition to television and being, she never really lost that weight after that, you know. She's the one who also taught me the concept of acting. I remember I was a little kid and I said to her, I was like, well, what is it that you do? I don't understand. What is acting, you know? And she did something, a real interesting experiment with me. She I was standing next to her. She said, see that chair over there? I said, yes. She said, go get that chair and bring it back and put it in front of me. I said, okay. I went up, walked over, picked up the chair, brought it back to her, and that was it. She said, okay, now put the chair back where it was and come back here. I said, okay. So I put the chair back where it was. I came back to her, and she said, now act it. And suddenly I was like, what? What do you mean? And she said, see, you could do it angrily. You could be happy about it. You might have an agenda. You may just – there's so many ways to think about going over that chair, just bringing over just that simple act, that the options, the choices you have, you know, and then to be directed on top of that. And it really filled my brain with, like, wow, that's what – oh, so acting is all these different ways you can approach something, you know? So
Absolutely.
I thought that was a fascinating little lesson as a kid, you know?
Man, I'm telling you, like you said, her career was so interesting and diverse that I'm surprised that someone hasn't thought of making a good biofilm of
her. Oh, that would be brilliant, a biofilm.
Yeah, especially like at this time now where I do think, especially female geeks want these heroes and are looking for these
totally.
Women to admire. I mean, Shelley is absolutely one of those people.
Absolutely. Listen, my mom got along with her so well because, you know, I guess, you know, she was a true feminist. For someone who, like, had no qualms talking about her sex life, she was a total feminist, you know? Like,
Understood.
That's part of being a feminist is discussing your sex life, isn't it? You know?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's – Hepburn was the same way. No, this is a very independent – Hepburn was the country club version of Shelley, who I would imagine was more of, you know, an urban kind of, you know,
absolutely.
Of the people sort of person. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh,
that's
man,
great.
Right.
I'm glad we got to talk about it a little bit. And you know, and this is a whole other not only a conversation, but probably even a can of worms. My dad knew Marilyn Monroe the last 8 years of her life. And if you look up James Haspiel, you're going to see a lot of pictures and a lot of stories of my dad and Marilyn. He's basically, he was the fan that became a friend, and he is the, world-renowned authority on her life, and he has much respect for her and much, love for Marilyn. Even when they try to disparage her, and try to, create controversy, he toes the line. And I grew up in a household where, Hollywood the legend of Hollywood, the history of Hollywood is very much a part of my growing up, and the stories that come with that, my God.
Well, yeah, I'm telling you, man, you got to I think there's some other comic books that you might have to collaborate with your mom and dad on to talk about some of this stuff, man.
Yeah, Zero Babylon.
Hey, man. No, I'm serious. And no, you can, and it doesn't have to just be, the smarmy stuff. It could be, again, I'm telling you, like I said, I have a new
lesson.
Marilyn, why not?
We all love, the controversies, the sex and violence, of course. But the lessons is what I want to walk away with. There's so many lessons in these stories, today, I joked recently with someone that I learned everything I learned about being in public, comic book, being in public in comic books from Paris Hilton, whipping off my shirt and whatnot. But that's a joke. I'm kind of making fun of myself, but I'm making fun of that, that's not interesting. What's interesting is the work, and how you arrive at it.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's the thing, man. No, you've had creative people in your life, and I think, I would think that there's a lot that you probably learned from your godmother, and
absolutely.
I think that would really be cool to explore, man. No, all right, there you go. This
Thank
is good.
You.
See, this, my man, it's always a pleasure, and I always learn a lot when I speak to you. I appreciate your ideas and your opinions on the comic market and where it is. It's my pleasure, bud, at any time, and it's always fun to have these discussions. So good luck with the Fox. Keep it up.
I hope so. Fingers crossed.
Absolutely, and in a couple months we'll talk about some other stuff as well.
All right. Thanks a lot, John.
There you go. Tremendous conversation with Dean Haspiel. Check out The Fox. It is out this week. The first issue comes out from Archie, from the Red Circle line, The Fox, both digitally and in print, on Wednesday, the 30th. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. Today's episode was brought to you by InStock Trades and InStockTrades.com. We're among the books on sale at InStockTrades.com. You can get Archie, The Married Life from Archie Comics, Trade Paperback Volume 4. I've been raving about this series ever since I first started picking it up. It's the future adventures of Archie, Betty, and Veronica. What if Archie had married Betty? And what if she had married Veronica? The book is split in two, and you get two very different storylines. Everybody going through some crazy soap opera sort of conflicts. But it's a great look at Archie in their adult years. Trade Paperback Volume 4 is 30% off. It's $13.99. You can get Mike Norton's creation, The Answer, scripted by Dennis Hopeless, 45% off, $17.14. You can also get from IDW the Doctor Who Omnibus, Trade Paperback Volume 2, containing all 16 issues, plus the 2010 annual and A Fairy Tale Life are collected in the second Doctor Who Omnibus. It is fantastic. It's 45% off, $16.49 from InStockTrades.com. Reach back for an old collection of Spider-Man. It's the trade paperback Life in a Mad Dog Ward, written by Ann Nocenti with art from Cynthia Martin. Awesome Bill Sienkiewicz cover. You get 45% off, $10.99 at InStockTrades.com. Check out all the deals there waiting for you now at InStockTrades.com. John Sutcher saying thanks again for listening to Word Balloon. Thank you, League of Word Balloon listeners, for your continued support. Truly appreciate it. And look forward to our usual format coming back on the next episode in just a few days. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2013.